reading, given everything we know about Netanyahu, everything he and his coalition have said. I'd love to think that this is a last gasp, and I hope that's how it plays out. But it doesn't look that way. There are three ways this can go. One, number one, this is something that Netanyahu cannot pull off. He feels cornered. He does the deal and it holds. That would be a precious thing. I don't think we're near that yet. The second is that Netanyahu says no, proves that he means no, this effort unravels. And then the question is, do the Americans, as they have done throughout, say, well, of course we have to blame Hamas. And I understand that for people to think that a Hamas negotiating position is more reasonable than an Israeli negotiating position, for those who follow mainstream American media, that's a hard disk to switch in your head. But that's the second option. The third option is the deal begins, but it unravels while it's being implemented. And if I could just zoom out for a moment, all of this is going on. We're talking about Gaza while the provocations in the West Bank continue to intensify. Every day there are disturbances there. It's not just settlers, it's the Israeli military. There are no settlers without the backing of the Israeli military, without the backing of the Israeli state. And we're still in an extremely uncertain time in the Israel-Hezbollah, Israel-Lebanon front. So all of this feeds into each other. And if this deal doesn't go through, I fear we're in for the much longer haul, and everything that you've reported on with such tenacity, and I give you credit for that, that has happened over the last months, I'm afraid will remain with us perhaps for an awfully long time.
And finally, we have 15 seconds. President Biden is giving what some are billing as one of the most important speeches of his administration, a speech on anti-Semitism. Daniel Levy, you're an Israeli former peace negotiator for Israeli prime ministers. Do you consider anti-Zionism anti-Semitism?
This is one of the most dangerous conflations imaginable. Desist from this now. We will fail in the struggle against anti-Semitism. We will fail to allow Jewish heterogeneity, which has been part of being Jewish throughout, the idea that one creed can be hegemonic and anything else is anti-Semitic, is an affront to Jewish history. Desist from this now, Mr. President.
Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Coming up, we go to Rafah for reaction to Israeli forces seizing the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. Stay with us.
Liebe Palästina, grossas Zionismen. Liebe, liebe, liebe Palästina. Liebe, liebe, liebe Palästina. Liebe Palästina, grossas Zionismen. Liebe Palästina, grossas Zionismen.
Und wir haben Ulat Juden.
Und wir haben Ulat Juden.
Und wir haben Föderbeten.
Und wir haben Föderbeten.
Palestina by the Swedish. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the Israeli military strikes Rafah in southern Gaza after Hamas agreed Monday to a ceasefire proposal, we go now to Rafah for an update on the situation there, including access to humanitarian aid. The White House said Monday a ceasefire does not have to be in place for a pier off of Gaza to be operational to bring in aid, but the pier's construction was temporarily paused last week due to bad weather. Israel seized the Rafah crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt overnight. This comes after Israel also closed the Karam Abu Salem crossing in southern Gaza this weekend after a Hamas attack killed four Israeli soldiers. For more, we're joined by Akram Al-Safari, the Gaza-based journalist joining from Rafah in southern Gaza near the Kuwaiti hospital. Akram, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what's happening on the ground right now? What does it mean that Israeli tanks have moved in, that they've seen the crossing with Egypt, and how are people responding?
Well, as a matter of fact, to start with, that means a lifeline has just been blocked. That means the movement of people who are traveling out of Gaza and people who are returning to Gaza has already been blocked. That means the patients who are in need to medical care and are transferred somewhere outside of Gaza are denied that access. That means the general population in southern Gaza and northern Gaza alike are deprived from the food supplies that were delivered and where even saw this last development take place, and that people are talking, and ironically they have been saying that Israel has been successful in two major military fronts yesterday. The major front number one is border, which is a civilian facility that is in charge of facilitating the entry and departure of people into and outside of Gaza. And number one, that the Israeli army succeeded in destroying the I Love You Gaza banner, which means they have been out and about to destroy anything that has to do with life or love in the Gaza Strip. People are extremely worried. They understand that they will be greatly affected by that operation, and they understand as well that Israel has been playing that card for the sake of consolidating its position when it comes to the negotiations that are still underway between Hamas and between Israel, which is brokered indirectly by Egypt and Qatar and supervision and support also of the American administration. The people in Gaza are afraid of the collective punishment that has been going on in Gaza North, and they see this move as a replication of the very same collective punishment techniques followed by the Israeli occupation forces, as they describe them, for the sake of just negotiating over the fate of people, weaponizing the food that people are entitled to as a human, weaponizing the health care and health supplies that are entitled to people as a human, and also weaponizing the shelter that has been destroyed. Yesterday, one third of Rafah population was asked to leave their homes and head to either to the very west of Rafah or to Khan Yunis and the Gaza central area. Tens of thousands of people are moving. Tens of thousands of people are in despair, and they understand that more destruction, more devastation, more death and deprivation is coming for them. So this is the overall atmosphere in Gaza. People are afraid. People are skeptical about them, of the Israeli army or for the Israeli political level to engage in negotiation, and they understand that they have been doing all they have been doing for the sake of undermining the possibility of living a decent life in Gaza, and for the sake of just pushing towards an ultimate objective and goal of the transfer of people of Gaza after rendering Gaza inhabitable.
And Akram, I wanted to ask you, all of this comes as Israel banned over the weekend Al Jazeera from reporting in the country and raided the Al Jazeera's Jerusalem bureau. So many reporters and Al Jazeera reporters have been killed since this war started. Do you fear that this is an attempt to stamp out any reporting from Gaza just before this new potential invasion of Rafah?
In general, the Israeli army and the Israeli political level are so fed up with the performance of all different media outlets. But the irony when it comes to Al Jazeera is that they have been talking about the freedom of expression, and now they are just banning Al Jazeera from transmitting the news bulletins from their, what they call their soil. They have killed so far 149, and they have been chasing different news outlets, including some of the review of the materials and of the news bulletins that are provided by the reporters on the ground, and then going after those reporters that might be providing some different narrative than the narrative that they want to see on the ground, that they want to see reported to the people and to the public. So the situation is extremely catastrophic, and I think they want to silence Al Jazeera, and they want to silence all the free media for the sake of preventing any further exposure of the things that are happening on the ground. Those things that include wiping out of whole families, destruction of very critical plants and facilities that are intended to purify the water that is going for the people who need them, and that's why people are suffering from severe health symptoms and problems, including upper respiratory systems, digestive systems, and all different type of health issues. Israeli government proved by its performance that they have been after the freedom of expression, and that they're willing to take an extra mile when it comes to banning that voice from going out for the people. And by banning Al Jazeera, they are supporting the analysis that they have been fighting against freedom of expression at all different fronts and levels.
Akram Nosatri, the issue of aid coming through. You have the World Food Program saying, that's Cindy McCain, saying that the North is in full-blown famine. Then you have the UN saying Israel's denying access to the southern Gaza Strip through the Rafah crossing as aid groups warn of impending catastrophe amidst chaotic scenes of families fleeing with no safe option for shelter. Can you talk about the aid situation right now as the closing of another border and how people are getting aid at this point?
Well, the aid has been extremely slow for the last few weeks or so. People were affected and the people were struggling for the sake of stockpiling, if that is the right expression. The right expression is to get any kind of food that they can serve their families on a daily basis. And the ones who were seeing that ground operation coming were hopeful that they would stockpile some of the food for the sake of just using it when they move from Rafah, because they were foreseeing a scenario within which the very same almost famine in the Gaza North would be replicated in the Gaza South. Now, with the very slow entry of the food, they could not store anything. And the blockade now that has been imposed on the Gaza South, which is a blockade by the literal meaning of the word. Now, Israel is controlling the Rafah border. Israel is controlling the area of Kerem Shalom. Israel is not allowing the entry of the humanitarian aid to Gaza, which is perceived as a lifeline for the people of Gaza, who lost their livelihoods, who lost their shelters, who lost their deals, who lost almost everything, but they're still willing to live and they need that food to live. Now this food is going to be denied. They are going to be denied access to aggravate the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in the Gaza Strip. The fear that has been voiced by the UNRWA, by the World Food Program, by the United Nations Development Program, by the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, which is a UN organization that is in charge of observing the situation and supervising and reporting about the situation. Technically, all the international organizations have been working about such a move that is likely to have a catastrophic impact on the life of Gazans. This catastrophic impact has already started last night. When the Rafah crossing was stormed, Kerem Shalom was stormed, people entered the area, were trying to get anything that they can get, anything they can put their hands on. Now, no food supplies whatsoever are coming from the Rafah crossing or from the Kerem Shalom. That is likely to affect people. Today, it is affecting people. And it will affect them in a much worse manner as time elapsed, because Israel would stay in that area and then they would resort to some nominal measures to show the world that they have been allowing food aid into Gaza. Gaza needs 1,000 trucks of food aid, of food supplies every day. Gaza has been receiving in the very first days of the crisis 5 trucks, 6 trucks, 10 trucks, 30 trucks, and Gaza in the recent days before the Passover was receiving around 230 trucks, still below the minimum, but now there's nothing, not even the minimum or nothing else, and Gaza is likely to continue suffering, and I think that is going to bring about more hunger, more starvation, and more death and suffering.
And Akram, I wanted to ask you, you're aware of these massive protests across the United States and Europe and other parts of the Western world in support of the Palestinians. Has news and information about these protests reached the people in Gaza? And are they heartened by some degree by the support of the young people in these countries?
Palestinians have been extremely grateful following the new major protest in all different, like, American universities in support of people of Palestine. Palestinians have been very grateful for the Jewish voices for justice and peace who have been galvanizing people into action. They have been following the news. Our the people who have been the culprit of that ongoing, they see it as an uprising and they call it Intifada after the name of the Intifada, the uprising that started in 1987, and they are grateful, they are hopeful, and they are extremely positive about that, and they hope that this kind of activism is going to lead the American, to prompt the American government to reconsider its positions from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and from the Gaza crisis. They're hopeful that this dynamic movement all over the United States is going to also line up more people in support of the Palestinian cause and in support of the right of the people of Palestine to live. And they think that this kind of action is leading and is paving the way to a ceasefire by pushing the American administration and by opening the eyes of the public. So it has the component of educating, it has the importance of advocating, it has also the operating level where they have been talking the talk, walking the walk, extending the helping hand, changing the dynamics in the hope something positive would happen. And personally, I see many positive things happening in the United States thanks to the efforts of the university students, thanks to the efforts of the humanitarian community, and thanks to the efforts to the Jewish voices who have been there for the, in support of Palestine and in support of humanity and justice. This is the perception of the Gazans, of the things that are happening. Gazans are amazed, Gazans are grateful, Gazans are hopeful that this kind of action would continue and would lead to something bigger and more positive and sustainable, including the sustainable ceasefire.
Akram al-Sathri, we thank you so much for being with us. Gaza-based journalist joining us from Rafah in southern Gaza. Next up, Gaza solidarity encampments continue. We speak with a Dartmouth professor who was body slammed to the ground, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth. Stay with us.
People they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, the police. Acts and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You can pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means, AIPAC, Koofi, and all the companies. You see we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You can ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance has always been about dollars.
Hins Hall by Macklemore. The song just came out, announced that all proceeds from the song go to UNRWA. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how Gaza solidarity encampments are continuing at college campuses across the U.S. despite brutal police crackdowns. In the latest roundup, at least 43 students were arrested Monday at UCLA. The Intercept reports after New York police raided Columbia University encampment last week, some of the arrested students were denied water and food for about 16 hours. Two protesters were held in solitary confinement. On Monday, Columbia canceled its main university-wide graduation ceremony May 15th, amidst mounting fallout from its mishandling of the peaceful protests. Meanwhile, Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner visited the University of Pennsylvania Gaza Solidarity Encampment last week to speak with organizers and legal observers.
The First Amendment comes from here. This is Philadelphia. We don't have to do stupid like they did at Columbia. We don't have to do stupid. What we should be doing here is upholding our tradition of being a welcoming, inviting city where people say things, even if other people don't like them, because they have a right to say it in the United States, and where protesters also have an obligation to remain nonviolent and to engage in speech activity and in activity that does not become legal.
That's Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner at the encampment at UPenn. This comes as more than 50 chapters of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, have issued a statement condemning the violent arrests by police at campus protests. This includes our next guest, Dartmouth professor, former chair of Jewish studies, Annalise Orlik, who says police body slammed her to the ground as she tried to protect her students when officers in riot gear cleared the peaceful encampment on Dartmouth's campus. Annalise Orlik is a professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Orlik was among dozens of students, faculty and community members arrested at the Dartmouth encampment last week. She's been charged with criminal trespass and temporarily banned from portions of Dartmouth's campus. She's joining us now from Thetford, Vermont. Professor Orlik, thanks so much for being with us. Can you take us through what happened that day? Where were you? Why did you decide to go to this encampment? And then what happened?
We were concerned that the students might be subject to some kind of violence. I didn't really think there was going to be arrest, but I didn't know for sure. The institution had sent out a very strict list of do's and don'ts earlier in the day, and it was clear that they were going to try to break up the encampment as quickly as possible. So there were a whole bunch of us, there were dozens of faculty out there to try to support them, and I was in a line of mostly older women, most of us Jewish. And the riot police came at us and started trying to literally physically push people off the green. We were standing in front of the students and the riot police in the hope of preventing violence. That didn't happen. My students and I were subject to really violent handling in the course of our arrest. And it's possible that I was subject to the most violent handling.
What happened to you?
I was videoing my students' arrests. I was telling the police, they're just students, they're not criminals, leave them alone. And suddenly I was body slammed from behind by these very large men in body armor, and hard enough that my feet left the ground for a few seconds. I landed on the ground in front of the protesters. They had taken my phone, and so I got up to try to demand my phone, and then they grabbed me under the arm, slammed me to the ground, dragged me face down on the grass. You know, one guy had his knee on me. And honestly, Amy, I heard myself saying what I'd seen in videos so many times: you're hurting me, I can't breathe, stop. And they said to me what they've said to so many victims of police brutality: you're talking, you can breathe. They then put on the zip tie cuffs on me, on a colleague, my colleague, Christopher McEvitt, and on many of our students so tightly that people have nerve damage, compressed nerves, severe pain. So that's what happened to us that night. And the university has not dropped charges for criminal trespass or even ask the DA to drop the charges. So we are all banned from the Green, which is the center of campus, from the administration building where we would go to protest, and from the street on which the president's house stands.
And Professor Orlik, the faculty met with the Dartmouth president yesterday, Monday. Could you talk about what was discussed and what was the message of the faculty to the administration?
The message of the faculty was: drop all the charges now, apologize for the harm and trauma you've inflicted on the campus, promise that there will be no riot police called to campus again, change your policies on protest to be less restrictive, and, you know, to acknowledge constitutional protections on free speech, and get rid of the Palestine exception to free speech. People have to be able to talk about Palestine without being attacked by police with clubs, gas, and God knows what else.
I want to ask you, Professor Orlik, you're a professor of history of women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies. President Biden is going to be giving an address on anti-Semitism today, issuing what they say is a clarion call to fight swiftly rising tide of anti-Semitism across the United States, and especially on college campuses. I put this question to the Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy as well. But if you can talk about whether you see this rise and also the equating of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and the number of Jewish professors and students who are part of these protests.
Yes, I think this protest movement has a large and disproportionate percentage of Jewish students and faculty involved, because we all feel very strongly that we don't want this genocide in Gaza in our name. And I was really struck by the fact that there was some reporting, I think by The Guardian and BBC, that I heard today, that The people stirring up a lot of trouble and saying things outside the gates at Columbia were tied to the Proud Boys, that there were people who attacked the protesters at UCLA so violently and who had ties to Trump rallies. And I think it's deeply ironic, deeply, deeply ironic that the House Republicans who supported the January 6th assault on the Capitol, in which people were wearing Camp Auschwitz shirts and shirts with a logo that says 6 MWE, 6 million wasn't enough, and that they have become the defenders against anti-Semitism. I heard nothing. There were Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish chaplains at our protest. The students were singing. They were chanting. Yes, there was some of the River to the Sea chant that many Jews find so offensive and believe is a call to genocide. I accept the interpretation made by my Palestinian colleagues and students that this chant is about equality from the River to the Sea and freedom. So I don't see any anti-Semitism, and you should know that many Jewish faculty at Dartmouth signed a letter insisting that the president not speak in our name and not use anti-Semitism to rationalize bringing these violent forces onto our campus.
And Professor, your message to organize these peaceful protests for months despite all of this repression?
Well, my students are our students are holding another rally today on one of the parts of the camp we're not banned from, which is the grass in front of the library. And I think their bravery is tremendous and it's inspiring. And they really feel like this is the moral issue of their time, that there's a genocide going on and that they can't ignore it. And again, I have colleagues at Columbia, colleagues at UCLA and in many parts of the country who have been not part of the encampments, but have visited the encampments, have spoken to the students there, have not felt threatened, have not felt anti-Semitism. Certainly at Dartmouth, we didn't. And there's a very powerful open letter from a Christian pastor who was there, who's saying the same thing. So stop weaponizing anti-Semitism. It's offensive and it's wrong.
Finally, Professor Ehrlich, how are you right now, having been beaten to the ground? And also, you're banned from your campus where you've taught for over 30 years, parts of it?
Yes, I was initially, as a condition of my bail, banned from the entire campus, but the college insisted that was a clerical error and, gave lie to their argument that they can't get, charges changed or dropped by calling the local police department and getting them to change my bail so that I can teach. So I can now teach, but my building is on one of the streets that I'm banned from. So I was having to run up the street yesterday in sunglasses really quickly, trying to get to my class, and not get arrested. It's ridiculous. And the green is the very center of our campus. We all cross it many times a day. My kids grew up playing on the green. The idea that we can't have access to the beating heart of our campus is offensive again. And, just gives a sense. The president makes this argument that she's trying to ensure that the green is open to people with all views and that, the 5 tents and 10 students who were camped out there would make the green a place that only people of one view could be. Honestly, I think that's what they did by making us frightened. I'm still hurting. I have nerve damage in my wrist. I have an injured shoulder. I have bruising and swelling, and it's very scary. And I'm getting better, but it's crazy that I should be in this position for trying to protect my students. And I say the same for other faculty who are out there, including Chris McEvitt, my colleague on the faculty, who was also arrested and also harmed.
Annalise Ehrlich, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Ehrlich, among dozens of students, faculty, community members arrested at a Dartmouth encampment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hello. Sorry to interrupt. I know you're busy enjoying one of your favorite shows on CJSF. But it's me, Robin, host of Roots and Berries on Fridays at noon. And I'm here with a very special delivery. Thank you for listening to CJSF.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.